We're going to wrap up our interview with Nathan Rennie this week and keep talking about Marxism, capitalism, socialism, and why none of this is good for the church in particular or good for faith. This is Matthew Garnett. Welcome to In Layman's Terms.
This is something else that Robin D.G. Kelly has written very well about. Dragging your feet and taking extra time on your breaks at work. These are forms of resistance that are always at play.
So you may be wondering why are we doing all this coverage of what seems to be pretty much political type issues. Well, I think this is one place where the political and the religious are going to overlap. If you recall, Marx said that religion is the opioid of the masses. And so in order for the kind of revolution these gentlemen were featuring on these few podcasts, in order for that kind of revolution to come about, you can't have people content with their lives. And one thing that Christianity does do, now it's hit and miss, it's got its peaks and valleys, of course, but it does give us joy. It does give us hope that even though things might be really bad and our wages might be bad and we may be being treated unfairly by the man at work or whatever else might be going on, that our hope ultimately doesn't lie in our economic or social status. Our hope lies in Christ. And that's something that really can't jive with a socialist vision, a socialist revolution, because if the proletariat, and that's us workers, that's us plebes, isn't discontent enough to revolt against the bourgeoisie, or you know, the man, our bosses, these sorts of things, then the whole socialist revolution can't happen. And so it's just something that's completely incompatible with faith at all, and it's going to come into conflict with it. And I think I just don't follow the logic. Now, a lot of these guys claim to be nonviolent, and I do see some ways in which some of this sort of protest can go on in a nonviolent way. But I just don't think you're going to get very far. I mean, look, at the end of the day, you know, like I say, I always bring this point up because this is something that went on. But one thing we wanted to do at Claremont was help illegal immigrants, illegal aliens, get on the government system in order to put strains on that system. See, but you know, and this sort of thing does put strains on the system. But I don't think this is one place I would have some critique of perhaps the more conservative media and political pundits is they really overemphasize how much strain it really does have on our country. Now, I think it's something to keep an eye on. I don't think it's something we should allow to go on. You know, just on principle, because you know, it's just kind of, where do you draw that line? How much of it are we going to let go on before we say, okay, this enough's enough, and we have to stop it? And things do have a tendency to spiral out of control, so we have to kind of keep an eye on these things. But you know, as far as really doing a peaceful revolution where we're going to see the United States turn into some sort of socialist utopia and that sort of thing, it just doesn't happen that way. There's really not a way in which a peaceful protest or peaceful revolution really fully bears itself out. And I think we're seeing that in South America, contrary to what some of these guys think that are on the Marxist socialist side of things, the communist side of things. You know, even in South Africa, where supposedly there was supposed to be this peaceful transition of power, apartheid ended, they got all that stuff straightened out. Well, unfortunately, the roles have reversed, and now there's very good evidence that that the government that is dominated by the black population has a hand in murdering white farmers, brutally so. And so, if there's any truth to that at all, this whole idea of peaceful revolution, I just don't think exists. I think there's a certain way to have a revolution, and you know. Again, it just it boils down to, you know, I think that the traditional, the more classical way, the way we won the American Revolution, you fight it against the ruling party, and if the ruling party loses, they either assimilate into your situation or they get out. They pull all their armies out. They get out of the country. They go elsewhere, and that's kind of how stuff, you know, generally speaking, seems to work. The peaceful revolution thing doesn't doesn't seem to work. And so I'm saying all that to say that this inevitably is going to devolve into violence, and it has to, or it just simply won't work. So, you know, there's a lot of ways to go. It's just something to keep an eye on. It, you know, these are the things that in our culture, you know, you take the whole sexual revolution. I think that is really their best if they want to upset the apple cart, if they really want to do their whole postmodern subversion of the system in order to replace the current, you know, evil system with their more utopian egalitarian ideals. Then probably the sexual revolution is getting them a lot further than anything, because that's eventually, you know, you destroy the family and you quit having babies and you quit raising babies, as you know, I'll talk about later on in the podcast with Nathan. You stop doing that, then your culture, your society, the West will cease, and I think that's a very viable strategy from the communist or the Marxist leftists that we're talking about right here. And you have them on a spectrum, you know, and we talked about those spectrums. You've got folks on the socialist spectrum, you've got other folks on the liberal capitalist spectrum, and you've got, you know, so in America there are people on the socialist spectrum, and they're going to range from these folks that we're kind of featuring here all the way to, you know, your Bernie Sanders types, all the way to your Elizabeth Warrens, your Joe Bidens. You know, that's the direction that they're going with this sort of thing. And if you don't think so, then you're not paying enough attention. and what that involves is eventually the dissolution, or the, you know, the illegalization of religious freedom. And we're seeing that play itself out. I mean, what would have happened had Hillary Clinton been elected and she appointed a revisionist judge to the court? What would have happened in the Masterpiece Cake Shop decision? It would have been, I'm fairly certain, would have been decided that that carte blanche, the 1964 Act, Civil Rights Act, would apply to gay couples, and that any Christian bakers, photographers who did not want to celebrate that or sell products or create services for it, you know, would be in violation of the law. So it would have been, you know, illegal to hold that conviction and also be a cake baker, because you would want to celebrate that sort of thing. So this all can kind of turn on a dime. And that's the way things, you know, can eventually come to a head, as you chip away at something long enough, and eventually it will collapse. It'll reverse itself, and stuff will start to spiral out of control very quickly. So I think it's important to keep an eye on this sort of thing. I also don't think, you know, I am absolutely convinced, and this is the thing that probably angers me more than anything, and I think I've voiced this before, is that the reason this stuff frustrates me so much is not because I'm afraid I'm going to lose kind of my status as a Christian. I mean, that ship sailed. You know, Christians have no status in this country really anymore to speak of, you know, in a real big way. I mean, you just look at the intellectual dark web. I mean, the best representative we have of Christianity, and we're going to get to this, by the way, because of the Jordan Peterson, Sam Harris debates came out on YouTube, and so I'm in the middle of analyzing those. There's a lot to go through, so it's going to take me a while to get through it, but I'm going to try to have a podcast out on it by the end of this week, for next time anyway. But at any rate, I mean, the best representative we have on the intellectual dark web, Christianity wise, is Jordan Peterson. And that's pathetic. I mean, he's a very poor apologist for Christianity, I must say, which is why I'm basically just going to step in and debate Sam Harris myself on these things. Now, he does make some good points, and he's always articulate, very smart individual. You know, and I think he's trying to get a grasp on these things, Jordan Peterson, but he's just missing some very essential tools as far as an apologetic goes to defend Christianity. He's trying to defend all religion, and that's a major mistake. But anyway, the point being that I'm not worried about my status as a Christian. I'm not worried about losing that. That's lost. It's been lost. We don't have that anymore. We just don't have that ground to stand on, and we're going to have to fight for every point. We're going to have to make our points starting from ground zero. That's why we talk about homosexuality the way we do here, you know, and talk about the reasons why it's a sin, not just that the Bible says it's a sin, but the reasons why the Bible says it's a sin. That's kind of the point where I have to start from, but I'm not worried about any of that. What I'm worried about is, you know, things like inner city Chicago. You know, this Marxist socialist, you know, these intellectuals sitting around, you know, jabbering about, you know, what needs to be done in the inner city and getting on TV and grandstanding about it is not helping these people. They need some real practical solutions, and so in throwing money at it, and that's basically what social programs propose. You just, so in some way, shape, manner, or form, throw money at it. And that's not solving the problem. In fact, I would argue that it's exacerbating the problem. And that is really the true crime in my estimation, all while we're, again, all worried about whether or not, you know, a gay couple gets a cake baked for them at a cake shop. These children are shooting each other in the streets. And I just think it's a misappropriation of energy and time and everything else. So that's where the real tragedy is. So while these Marxist socialists pontificate on YouTube and on podcasts, to the tune of making, Chapo Trap House makes, $100,000 a month on Patreon, making utility of the capitalist system, while they whine about, conditions in the inner city or conditions in this certain country and so on and so forth. These people are really suffering and they need real solutions and not your failed theories that have failed time and time again and devolved into terrible, terrible violence and just a horrible situation for everyone. So that's why we're talking about this, because as Christians, it's something we should definitely care about. Because they are coming and have come for us, and that's okay. But in the midst of this, we also need to be looking for real solutions to how we can defend and help the people who really are poor and needy, and the widows and orphans among us, and how we can give them real solutions and not just pipe dreams about some sort of egalitarian utopia that'll never come about. Anyway, so there's my sermon for this time. Anyway, we're gonna do Nathan and I first, when we get through that, then I'll come back, and there's a couple more clips that I want to go through before we kind of wrap this saga of a few podcasts up on in layman's terms. Okay, here we go.
Another thing too, so this putting racism and capitalism together, I think on the Dig podcast, which we just listened to that clip, they kind of explained a little bit about what was happening there, where they quoted that scholar saying something like, as if the main point was to degrade black people during slavery and not simply to make more product or make more money. So what I think that's really interesting. So they basically say that because of the drive for profit and the drive to produce more things and attain more power, I guess, that is why you eventually do get racism. And then I think about what they were talking about in that podcast earlier about how white people were often racist towards other white people because they call them white trash, right? Didn't they say that?
Yep.
So everything, all the puzzle pieces come together here now. And so when they say things like, well, if you meet someone and they're not a racist, they're probably a socialist, that seems kind of vapid.
Yeah.
Vapid? Is that the way? I'm sorry.
No, you got that. Yeah.
I mean, it's like I understand they don't want to, they want to hold all of these problems together in tension and everything else. And they don't want to become, as they say, class first Marxists,
right,
or class first socialists. But it just seems like kind of it is a way of just really confusing and making problematic those questions about race and ethnicity too.
Right. Well, and that's where I think they talk in this podcast a lot about intersectionality and how that term has been hijacked. Again, this goes back to the quote black white distinction, and I think I talked a little bit about this last week. In this theory, technically, I would be considered black. So in Marxist theory, you've got the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. Well, those terms have been replaced with your intersectionality type of talk, where the proletariat's now your oppressed minorities. So in this podcast, again, they talk about, if we can free the black woman, then everybody will be free, right? That's the idea. So,
you know, again, you know, I might not be as oppressed as a black woman, but I'm still in that intersection of, I'm still caught in the crosshairs of this, you know, of this racist capitalist system, which is exploiting my labor, so people can have profit, et cetera, et cetera. So what these guys want to do is like, hey, we all need to get together on this. You know, you're part of the oppressed too, you know, and you don't need to fake it like Rachel Dolezal does, you know, in order to be a part of this movement, right? That's really the plea they're making, you know, to somebody to somebody like me. Hey, let's all get together on it, because, you know, we all have this common enemy, and it's going to take all of us coming together in solidarity to do this. So, you know, so right, and that's where the, you know, kind of the postmodern language games comes in, and you can alter terms or deconstruct terms and you make terms vacuous in order to forward your agenda, because after all, again, the point is, does it subvert? You know, are we resisting? How are we resisting? You know, let's use all the means possible to resist, and all the people possible to resist, and to bring about this egalitarian utopia is really the ultimate goal. And again, I have a hard time believing these guys are violent. Most of them, you know, put forth a non-violent stance, but that's the thing. I don't even think they get that they're, you know, or maybe they do. They're going to have to convince people to jump tracks. And for anybody who knows anything about the history of socialism, you know, especially us as Christians, you know, when we hold our faith dear, and we want to keep our faith, that's going to be a big problem for us. So at any rate, and then at the end of the day, it's not even me I'm worried about. I mean, if the socialists took over the country and Christianity had to go underground, that'd be a bummer. I think Christianity thrives better when it's not under persecution, honestly. I think under persecution, the church is more genuine. But as far as doing evangelism and preaching the gospel, it's I think much better done when the church is at peace and not under oppression. But if that happened to us, okay, that's fine. But my big concern is that a group like the black community, you know, of the inner city, is jumping right out of the frying pan into the fire. This is not going to ultimately be helpful to them. You know, again, as you know, we've said here, the whole idea is we're, you know, we care about the neighbor. And, you know, I think until people, it's just, hopefully this will simmer down a bit and we can actually start to have some honest discussions about these sorts of things on good faith to say that, hey, you know what, we care about black people too. We care about black lives. We care very deeply about these things, and I think those on the socialist spectrum obviously care about these things, and so the big problem is that the two sides can't, it doesn't seem like they can come to a place where they can genuinely say, yes, we believe that you care about these things, and them say, yes, we believe that you guys care about these things. We have two totally different approaches to this. How can we, you know, how can we go forward? But we can't even make that step yet, because again, you know, when it boils down to, you've got to call all capitalists racists, and you don't, you know, then the discussion can't go forward. There's no air in the room. That just kind of sucks it all out. I don't know. Any final thoughts there? I know you got to go pretty quick.
Yeah, no. I think what you're saying there makes a lot of sense. It does suck all the air out of the room.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, one early moment of this is precisely the response of African-American communists like Cyril Briggs and Harry Haywood to Marcus Garvey. And, you know, Marcus Garvey had the Back to Africa movement, but what Haywood pointed out was that the homeland of black people was not Africa, of black Americans was not Africa. It was the U.S. South, where they had been for centuries and had established a culture and a society. And so that kind of idea that there was some kind of mythical origin at which the essence of the race could be rediscovered or found once again. That was very severely criticized by black communists. And as I said before, the response was to say that actually the demand for self-determination, we can't let the nationalists monopolize that. We have to take it up as a multinational communist party. And then, of course, you know, the Nation of Islam is another mass movement, and Malcolm X's evolution is very complicated, because even in the period when he's still advocating for, he's still a separatist, basically, he's taking his lead from the global revolutionary situation. He's pointing to China and Vietnam, and he even refers to the Russian Revolution as an example of the kind of program that he wants for black people in the United States.
All right, thoughts there.
Why don't you throw in some of your thoughts first about that? Well, and then I'll just quickly say like a couple minutes and then you can wrap it up. Does that sound okay?
Yes, sounds good. All right, so there we have, you know, kind of the talk of, and I'm not sure where this particular individual is at with, you know, with making appeals to communist China, Vietnam, the Russian Revolution. That's one thing I never hear these guys talk about is, okay, they're pushing for this thing which historically has killed and tortured millions of people in its wake and is currently doing so, like we pointed out, in South Africa. You know, that's what I'd like to hear them talk about. You know, when Malcolm X was putting forth his program, this was really before we knew the full breadth of what was going on in Soviet Russia or even China. You know, that sort of information didn't come to us really until Stolenitsyn was able to get the Gulag Archipelago published in America, and everybody was able to read about it, and then all that came to light.
Exactly.
Yeah, and so now that it's all out in the open, and we know where these programs lead, guys, please, you know, how can you give me the old saw of, well, nobody's ever really actually done socialism right? You know, you just can't. There's nowhere to point to, and you're going to come along and say you're going to do it right. I mean, I've never heard anybody give a convincing argument from Noam Chomsky on down. You know, all I can see this becoming for everybody, especially the poor people, is ending in disaster. And you can again look at the economy in South Africa: 30% unemployment. They're on the food supply is short. Where's this going to lead us? You've got to seriously contend with that. You not just talk, you know, in theory about let's get everybody together for the revolution. I don't know. Have you heard any of these guys kind of discuss anything along those lines?
Well, not really. I mean, I have heard Douglas Lane from Zero Books basically asks the question of other people, sometimes his guests, about like, well, you know, where is this working? Because this seems to be a pretty convincing argument that the right has. So, you know, what are some things that we can point to? And you don't really ever hear a whole lot. I mean, these guys are bringing this stuff up in this context because they want to say, well, obviously we're not going to go in that direction, right?
Yeah.
But, and the thing is like, there was a time when even for Christians, I mean, I think it might be kind of understandable that so many of them were snookered by communism. I mean, yes, it does say in the Bible that we should pay taxes to Caesar, so why not a little bit more of our property too? And why not have this focus on the common good? Isn't that what social justice is all about? Aren't we supposed to be concerned about the wider community and not just our own selves and our own families? And didn't the church in the book of Acts in chapter 2, didn't they sell all their possessions and just kind of live communally more? Well, it's like, yeah, you have that for that brief period in Acts chapter 2, but they were doing that willingly. They weren't coerced and everything else. In any case, you can understand, I think, how some people might have found this attractive, even Christians. But yeah, then there's Solzhenitsyn. Then there's the experiment is in, as Jordan Peterson has said numerous times. Yeah. And yeah, it's pretty disastrous. And so, you know, Peterson goes so far as to basically, assign moral culpability to people who would promote socialism and communism and things like that. And I think he's right to do so, because history is something that we should learn from. And history is an important thing, and we can't deny what happened then and what, like you said, in South Africa is going to happen now.
Right, right, right. Well, and so what's my answer to all this? Well, so I'm a big, you know, grandiose egotist in a lot of ways. I've struggled with that sin my entire life, narcissistic, you know, and all that nasty stuff. And so there, for pretty much the majority of my adult life, I've tried to think of myself, you know, this big, I want to be this big world changer. And there, you know, that dark time in my life where I was like, I've got no answers, you know, and I'm not changing the world. What am I going to do now? Am I just going to, you know, give it up and do what? I don't know. What can I do? And I just thought, well, you know what? I'll just be a husband and a father. That's just what I'm going to do. Cause I'm not going to be able to do this world changing thing. I don't have any answers. And so I'm just going to go to work and try to make money for my family and provide for them. And, that was, I think, the beginning of the Holy Spirit drawing me back to faith, because that was part of the answer. I don't think we can do anything on this big grandiose scale. I think we have to, as individuals, enter into the church community, like you've stated, and focus on helping, focus on having children, raising them in the faith, and then having them have children and raising their children in the faith, and let that thing perpetuate itself. I mean, that's ultimately how it works. No, you know, nobody's going to come along with a magic wand and just pew, change this stuff. We've got, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why I love the Lutheran faith, is because we have a heavy emphasis on children, having lots of children and families, and staying married, and instilling values in our children. And if everybody did that, I think we'd be in pretty good shape. If we're going to do anything in the broader community, you know, even if it's, I think a beginning toward drawing people toward the faith, the Holy Spirit uses the institution of the family. And so if we can talk to people about, hey, have you thought about having a family? Have you thought about being devoted to your family? You know, you'd be surprised how, you know, what a difference that's going to make in the world. I mean, that's the primary thing, you know, and that's one thing I wish, you know, a guy like Jordan Peterson would talk a lot more about, because he talks about these grandiose things like slaying dragons and rescuing your father from the, you know, well, what does that look like on the ground? What that looks like on the ground is you get up every morning, you bust your rear at work so you can provide for your family, and you teach your children the Bible. That's what it looks like.
Amen.
Yeah. And, you know, and if I somehow get the opportunity to teach some young men how to drive trucks, you know, that's the other thing that I want, you know, to hopefully inspire them toward is, you know, is being men who have wives and children, and instilling those types of values in them. And so it's not this big grandiose, you know, change the world plan. It's very simple, very straightforward idea. Just be the man in the manner in which Holy Scripture describes it, which means you get up, you go to work, you provide for your family, you teach them the Bible. That's my solution.
Okay, so there's the rest of the interview with Nathan, and now I'm going to get onto a couple of clips. We had a whole thing planned out. We just got bogged down in some of this. There's just so much here. I probably threw a little bit too much at him, but there's a couple other things from some of these podcasts. Some of them I came across, some of them mostly Nathan came across and sent them to me for my evaluation. But I want to get to a couple more of these clips, you know, especially from our friends at Zero Books here, and go over them to just kind of point out what precisely is going on here. And you know, more or less for your understanding, you know, and being able to recognize this when it goes on in culture. So let's get back to a couple of the clips and see how it goes.
You know, the Black Panther Party had a very hostile relationship to cultural nationalists, and in their case it was primarily with Ron Karenga's US organization. And you can read a lot of people's accounts of this. For example, I was looking recently at the account of Elaine Brown in her memoirs. She was a major leadership figure in the Black Panthers, and she said she talked about going to one of the meetings of the US organization, and the women had to eat in a separate room. And they were like, no, we're not going to do that. It's like there was some idea that that corresponded to African culture, and that's how they had to behave. Of course, it was. I have a chapter in the book about Amiri Baraka, who was very inspired at first by Ron Karenga and was a cultural nationalist for a period, until he finally rejected that for Marxism. And he rejected it for Marxism when he realized that the first black mayor of Newark, Kenneth Gibson, who had been put in his position in no small part by the black nationalist organizations of Newark, when he realized that Gibson was just joining in with the existing status quo of municipal politics, and that it was necessary to attack the whole system, at that point he became a Marxist. But
so that's really more of that idea of the system being the problem. So again, when you hear certain people talk about being white, try to figure out, are they talking about liberal capitalism? Because in the Marxist socialist vision, at least the neo-Marxist socialist vision, that notion of being white means that you are a liberal capitalist. Again, Nathan and I went over this last week, but that's the reason Ben Shapiro is a racist, because he believes in capitalism. See, that's how that connection is made. And unfortunately, Ben doesn't see that, doesn't really understand kind of some of those dynamics. And not that they're easy to recognize. I mean, it took me a really long time to kind of get all this sorted out. But anyway, that's exactly what he's talking about here with that election. And that's what's been the frustration of this movement, especially when it relates. I mean, there's a lot of dynamics going on here since the 1960s. Now, Black Panthers are very, very central to this, because they did want to see people from their party get elected and start to change the system. Start to, like, we listened to Eldridge Cleaver. He was the leader of the Black Panthers, and we heard him say directly that, communist socialist countries, they're doing it right, and that's what they want to bring about here. And when they elected officials of color that were black, who were on board with the program, and then they ended up getting kind of co-opted into this liberal capitalist status quo. That's another buzzword, by the way, when you hear Marxist or socialist, or when somebody mention the status quo, that whole idea of, you might be a redneck. Well, when somebody says something about the status quo, that is a buzzword among Marxist socialists to say that what we're trying to do is get rid of liberal capitalism. That's the status quo. See? and so when these black officials get elected and they kind of get co-opted into the status quo, quote unquote, they get caught up in politics, and politics are complicated. It's very difficult. And that's one thing that's very frustrating to socialists, is that it's very, very difficult to change things in our system. It takes a vast will of the people. I mean, you can change the Constitution, but there's a process by which you have to go through to change the Constitution. That's why they've turned to the courts in a lot of ways, is because it's way easier to turn to change something in the courts. That's why they are all, weeping and wailing and the gnashing of teeth over over Kennedy's resignation, was because the one way they could usurp the Constitution and our legislative process and the separation of powers was to go through the courts, and they were doing it very successfully. See, and so when officials get elected and they don't immediately move to get this status quo changed or start to chip away at it at least, then people start to get very upset. Personally, I thought Barack Obama did a terrific job with Obamacare. That was a great move. If that's indeed the agenda, because I mean, look, he's virtually subverted and destroyed the American healthcare system. It's a complete mess. Nobody knows what to do with it now. And you know, that was kind of the point, was to get it to a situation where people just throw up their hands and say, okay, well, just let the government take it over. It'll be much easier and cleaner that way. And you know, and there you go. There we got. We have one more socialist program that we didn't have before. All right. So hopefully, you know, there's some smart people up there, you know, like my man Senator Cruz, who can figure some of this stuff out. But that's kind of how it's done. And so these parties, especially these radical parties, get very upset when they elect people or when people get elected, and they end up getting caught up into the status quo. So that's an important point to point out there. Also, you kind of see how it's difficult for them as well, because when you start dealing with intersectionality, you know, and you have some conflicts of interest within the intersexual in groups, quote unquote. So, for instance, one major conflict going on right now is, you know, how is this whole transgender movement conflicting with feminism? Because, you know, when Bruce Jenner was put on the cover of Sports Illustrated as quote unquote Caitlyn Jenner, and you know, as the female athlete of the year, I mean, if I was a female athlete who really had a great year that year and did really well and, you know, did something, you know, was really kind of active for women's sports and this sort of thing, you know, and I kind of got pushed aside by somebody who is a man, there's going to be some conflict there. And there already has been some conflict there. So that's an interesting piece as well. But yeah, just to point out those couple of things, what happens with this is something that Thomas Sowell pointed out in his latest book, that as the African American community has been able to get a lot of black people elected, especially to mayorships in inner cities, and it just simply has not made a difference. They haven't been able to change the status quo. They haven't been able to bring about, you know, more equality of outcome or even equality of opportunity for that matter. And it's frustrating. It gets really frustrating to folks who are really suffering, and that's completely understandable, because you think, hey, if we could get this guy elected, then maybe we could actually get something done that will help us. And when it doesn't turn out that way and stuff actually gets worse, it's really disheartening. It's really disheartening.
Pointed out, like, look, this is an invention. It's cobbling together hippie culture with Islam, with, you know, a kind of racist mythology about what Africa is. This was his reflection when he was in his Marxist period, back on what kind of culture these cultural nationalists were advocating. And it turned, you know, it was something that was fundamentally not only sexist and oppressive internally in its own various ways, it also didn't have an effective politics. It was based on a mythology. It wasn't responding to the American power structure. It was mainly about building a kind of counterculture.
You brought me to the next thing I wanted to talk about in terms of Baraka's disaffection with Newark Mayor Gibson, which is part of this broader push in the 70s to win black power in City Hall, in city halls all over the country. And you write, desegregation made it possible for black businessmen and politicians to enter into the American power structure on a scale that had not been possible before. And these elites were able to use racial solidarity as a means of covering up their class positions. If they claimed to represent a unitary racial community with a unified interest, they could suppress the demands of black working people whose interests were, in reality, entirely different from theirs. And this argument about the incorporation of the black elite into the elite is that it was accomplished in part by way of identity politics, this notion of black faces in high places, which Kienga in From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation, another book, excellent book of hers, calls the most significant transformation in all of black life over the last 50 years.
Right, so there's just a little bit more of the same idea there that that essentially, and again, this kind of answers the phenomenon of why is Condi Rice so looked down on by the quote black community? You know, your Al Sharptons, your Jesse Jacksons, etc. Why is Clarence Thomas so attacked? And this is the very reason, is because they are on the liberal capitalist spectrum. See, that's the whole point. They've become, for all intents and purposes, white. You guys wonder why there's this talk of getting your black card revoked? That's why. Because when you bail on the project of Marxist, socialist, you know, radical revolutionary agenda, this is all rooted in the Black Panther Party and you know, the post Civil Rights Act of 1960s. This is where this stuff comes from. And so when you abandon the Marxist socialist spectrum for the liberal capitalist spectrum, you have effectively turned in your black card, quote unquote. See, you've been co-opted by the system, which is, as we saw in the last interview, inherently racist. And that's exactly what went on. These quote black faces in high places didn't end up working out. They ended up being co-opted by the system, and worse. But it didn't accomplish what they hoped it would in any way, shape, manner, or form. And is pretty disappointing.
Cite a passage from Nikhil Paul Singh's book Black as a Country, where he writes that the dominant narrative of the civil rights movement, quote, fails to recognize the historical depth and heterogeneity of black struggles against racism, narrowing the political scope of black agency in reinforcing a formal legalistic view of black equality. To what extent does this reigning view of identity politics that we've been talking about, to what extent does it require, does it rest upon this other thing, which is the sanitization of the history of the black freedom movement, the same thing that, you know, made Dodge Ram think it was a great idea to put an MLK speech in their Super Bowl ad?
That's an interesting question, because, you know, the appropriation of Martin Luther King, the mainstream appropriation, was introduced by Ronald Reagan. You know, he signed Martin Luther King Day into law. So it's something that actually stretches beyond, if we're talking about the civil rights movement, it certainly stretches beyond the kinds of populations who now speak about identity politics. Do you think that a lot of people who are now in the discourse of identity politics are specifically citing the civil rights movement?
No, I don't think they're specifically citing it, but I think that this extremely narrow linguistic emphasis of many so-called identitarians today requires an ignorance and sanitization of the black freedom movement history.
Certainly, one of the important things to study and recognize is that the civil rights movement, which made the major achievements that it did and pulled off these massive mobilizations, it was based in a radical tradition, and there was never any conception that the politics of race and the politics of class were separate. You know, I mean, Rosa Parks, for example, was radicalized by some Communist Party anti-racist campaigns. There was the connection to the Socialist Party and the labor movement with A. Philip Randolph and Bayard Rustin. Certainly, Martin Luther King came out of the black church. So apparently, as a young man in graduate school, he was extremely interested in Marx, according to some biographers. But he also, and I think this is something that is underappreciated, at least I don't see too many people commenting on it, that we talk a lot about how Malcolm X and the Black Panther Party connected the black freedom struggle in the United States to the global anti-colonial struggle. And we know, for example, that Martin Luther King, in the last year of his life, exactly 1 year before he was assassinated, gave this speech against the Vietnam War, in which he seems to express a lot of sympathy with the Vietnamese struggle for self-determination, though he doesn't come out right and say it. But actually already at the beginning, in the early mid-50s, he was connecting the black freedom struggle in Montgomery to the Indian independence struggle. That's what nonviolence meant. Nonviolence meant a connection to Gandhi and the struggle against colonialism in India. And so that kind of internationalism was always a part of the civil rights
movement. And in his commentary on his time in Calcutta, he very much makes it clear that his interest in economic justice is a universal one as well.
He's absolutely explicit about the connection with economic justice. If you read 1964, Why We Can't Wait, you can read that and just see how clearly and that's years before the Vietnam moment. It's before the turn to black power. He didn't need to be pressured from outside by black power to say these things about economic justice. And of course, in 1957, he went to Ghana for the Declaration of Independence, and he stopped in London to meet with C.L.R. James. These networks and connections were always there. They were part of the Black Freedom Movement throughout. And I think another thing that should be understood is that in the late 60s and throughout the 70s, many people who came out of the New Left made a turn towards communism and Marxism, they weren't necessarily parties, but organizations which they hoped would turn into communist parties.
Okay, so that's really just a very long dialogue between the two gentlemen here, demonstrating that Martin Luther King, the black movement, has its roots in Marxism and communism. Now, I think there's a solid argument to be made for that, and I think they may be right about this in some ways. I think we should be grateful for Martin Luther King Jr. and what he did, but we also can't, like they're talking about, can't sanitize him. He had a socialist agenda. Remember, when we're talking about economic justice, what are we talking about? We're talking about socialism. We're talking about equality of outcome, and I don't think you can argue very well that Martin Luther King Jr. wasn't for this. I think he was. I think that what has happened, yes, in some ways, is we've taken Martin Luther King Jr. and we've turned him into somebody who just says, "Hey, we want equal opportunity for everybody in this wonderful liberal capitalist system." That was really, unfortunately, not King's agenda. However, I think we can take those ideas and say, okay, yeah, we think that this is possible, because I absolutely do. I believe that we can have this is where we should be striving and struggling and working, as a church, as Christians, within our own families, and then among our neighbors, to strive and struggle for equality of opportunity. Because I think if we could get there, if we could show people that they have this great opportunity in this liberal capitalist system, that it's not all that bad. There's really nothing else. It's better than anything else we've ever come up with. It's way better than what's gone on in communist China and Soviet Russia, et cetera, et cetera. We said this many times, okay? At any rate, let me play a couple more interesting clips from this just to kind of demonstrate that I'm not making this whole thing up of subverting the system. There's a couple interesting clips along those lines.
Securing the struggles to survive that people are engaged in every day, and the resistance that people engage in every day, even if it's not recognized as such. This is something else that Robin D.G. Kelly has written very well about dragging your feet and taking extra time on your breaks at work. These are forms of resistance that are always at play, and this rhetoric, this metaphysical rhetoric of victimhood, as I was referring to earlier, takes that agency, that possibility of resistance,
because it suggests that people don't have brains, not intentionally, yeah. but don't know. The last thing I want to talk about is that this discussion, this debate that you're writing out, is not just academic, to invoke an anti-intellectual colloquialism. These politics can concretely be quite destructive in organizing campaigns, in people doing political work.
Yeah.
You write about your own experience organizing to fight tuition hikes at UC Santa Cruz. Explain what happened.
We had the occupation of a building and successfully ejected the administration, and had held that building for a couple days. And, you know, the trajectory was not clear at that point where things were going to go. But somehow the idea began to circulate that this was a movement of white anarchists or white Marxists, and that it was not a safe space for people of color. And the primary organizers were just completely taken by surprise by this. I wasn't one of them, by the way. I was a supporter and participant, but it had been mainly undergraduate students who had organized it. And most of these primary organizers were people of color, and they were just completely taken aback by this. And you know, there were attempts to respond, but there was what ultimately happened is that a group called itself the People of Color Caucus, and it was a group of some people of color who had showed up, you know, had not been involved in the previous organizing, but had showed up to participate. And I went to one of their meetings. White people were not allowed, and they basically planned out a split, and they took about half of the remaining people at the occupation with them and sort of destroyed the reputation of the occupation. And that's pretty much the experience that got me to start writing the materials that led to this book.
Wow.
Just by seeing just how destructive it was, and how these particular languages circulated and were used in such depoliticizing ways. So that's what drove me to write the book.
A related thing that this makes me think of is that identity politics also, I think, serves as a framework that allows certain people of color who are elites, whether domestically or second or third world elites, to ironically kind of launder their own privileges and establish some false equivalency of their own conditions and situations with black oppressed masses in the United States.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, and it was absolutely true in this situation. And, you know, sometimes I just want to scream, like, what do you think you're talking about when you say privilege when you live in the United States? I mean, like, just step outside this country and step outside of Europe for a minute, and you will realize that compared to billions of people in the world, you are outrageously privileged.
You know.
Okay, so that's really fascinating. Really fascinating argument. An argument I've made a number of times, and I'm going to circle back to it because there's a number of things going on here. First of all, notice the comment about dragging your feet at work, taking a little extra time at breaks as a form of protest. This is exactly, again, what we were engaged in Southern California at Claremont. You know, these are the ideas that we talked about behind, you know, even environmental movement, feminist movement, these sorts of things. And what Hyder here is trying to put forth is the idea that, you know, and we didn't, I don't know if we covered this part of the podcast. Again, you can go find it. I think you can just Google the Dig Mistaking Identity Politics, and it should come right up on Player FM. If you need to, send me an email, send you a link to it. But throughout it, he was talking about how poor whites in the South are somebody that this movement needs to have solidarity with. That even though these people might have a racist tendency against black bodies, that's another kind of catchphrase, colloquialism, if you will. you know, among these neo-Marxists is, you know, there is a difference between black bodies and white bodies, all right? That's one thing. But when we're talking about black and white, we're really talking about a political agenda, really. Again, the spectrums of the socialist spectrum, the liberal capitalist spectrum, these sorts of things. And so so you see that there are these forms of protest that really don't have any purpose other than really primarily to subvert the system. They come across as, I mean, these are the more bald-faced ones, but there are also more subtle ways to accomplish these sorts of things. You know, you see these Occupy movements, and this gentleman is frustrated that somehow this got labeled as a white supremacist Marxist thing, and there's some infighting with them and the black people there, and then finally he's frustrated with how you know, people in the United States, you know, want to point the finger and say, you know, you're privileged to other poor people in the country who happen to have white bodies, and when at the same time, compared to, like you said, billions of people around the world, they are in fact the privileged ones. So at any rate, it's pretty interesting where this discussion goes. But at the end of the day, what we need to realize, the agenda is, and the socialist vision is trying to get this massive uprising of people. That was Marx's vision, that eventually the proletariat would basically just get sick of it, and they would unify together in solidarity. That's the last line of the Communist Manifesto: workers of the world, unite. Unite for what? Unite in solidarity against the proletariat. Now, Marx was pretty much talking about trying to take over the means of production, right? And we can talk about that. But eventually, again, this circles back to what I initially talked about when we started the podcast, was A, it's going to have to boil down into violence. I mean, sorry, occupations like this, the one that Heider is talking about here, unfortunately, they are violent in nature. I mean, if a group of students goes and takes over an administration building, what's going to be, you know, if they decide to do that indefinitely, what's ultimately going to be the answer? There's going to have to be violence involved. The police are going to have to come. There's going to have to be arrests made, et cetera, et cetera. And then what happens when, you know, they're finding out that these, you know, these peaceful sit-ins or whatever, these occupations are only resulting in their arrest? Well, they're going to have to take things to the next level, unfortunately. And then on top of that, they can't have Christians coming along and talking about hope outside of economic equality or utopia here on earth. They can't be exposed to this opiate, as Marx proclaimed. And like I said, I just don't see how this is ultimately helping anybody, these types of discussions. You know, when really I'm convinced the real problem, like I said in the last podcast, is get married, have children, raise your children to be Christians, and all would be well. I'm convinced that's the deal. And that's the call to us Christians still today. And it starts right with your family. You don't have to go out and do anything profound. Just start right with your family. Anyway, hope this makes sense, and hope you can see how counter, how absolutely opposite this is to the Christian worldview, and how it should be resisted with the Christian ethos. Okay, there it is. We are done with that. No, it was long, but I enjoy this sort of thing, so that's what you get. Anyway, don't forget to donate to Kibos Hope Academy. I forgot to mention that at the outset. $50 will get the Well Project started. We can complete that, knock that domino over. It'd be a huge deal there. Talk about, you know, using our privilege to help those less fortunate. That's a big deal. Also, don't forget to check out our Kenyon Christian Arts, and check us out on KNNA The Cross in Nebraska. We'll see you next time.
Hey, preacher man.